Hello, you're listening to East London Radio. I'm Rosie McLeod. This June is Waltham Forest Safe and Well Month, which aims to raise awareness about safety, safeguarding and well-being within Waltham Forest. As part of the month-long campaign, we're bringing you this episode about an often taboo subject of domestic abuse. It's estimated that one in four women and one in six men will be victims of domestic abuse at some point in their lives. In the year 2013, 1.2 million women and 700,000 men were known to be the victims of domestic abuse in England and Wales. In the same time span, the Crown Prosecution Service received 80,000 domestic abuse claims, and there are thought to be as many as 35 incidents before help is sought. According to Women's Aid, 32% of the women and 11% of the men who experience domestic violence do so at least four times. Closer to home, 2,019 victims of domestic abuse came forward between the 1st of April 2013 and the 31st of March 2014, of which 12% were repeat victims. That's in Waltham Forest alone. Waltham Forest Children's Social Care cites domestic violence as the most common risk to children in the area. It accounts for many being removed from their parents and taken into care. Local police data reveals that at least 150 children witnessed domestic violence in the area during the year 2013 to 2014. Yet domestic abuse remains a significantly underreported crime in Waltham Forest. Even with an increase in declared cases over the past 3 years, the number of disclosed cases is lower than expected. This is thought to be because victims feel trapped or alone. A lack of awareness of what defines domestic abuse also prevents it from being recognised when it happens. Would you be able to tell if your relationship were an abusive one? In this programme, we'll help you to identify if that's the case and provide contact information for the support available. Domestic abuse concerns every last one of us. The local statistics show it's not being talked about, and as something that usually happens behind closed doors, turning a blind eye only puts more people in danger. We'll be discussing the signs of abuse and how you can make the call for help as a concerned neighbour, relative or friend. A bit later, survivors of domestic abuse will be sharing their experiences and we'll be talking to Solace Women's Aid about the services provided by the group. But first, let's look at that all-important definition of domestic abuse. Until recently, the offence was known almost solely as domestic violence. It was synonymous with wife beating and stereotyped as concerning only married or cohabiting couples. It's now known as domestic violence and abuse and may apply in cases where the relationship is casual and non-violent. Although it's not a legal definition, the UK government defines the offence as this: any incident or pattern of incidences of controlling, coercive, threatening behaviour, violence or abuse between those aged 16 or over who are or have been intimate partners or family members, regardless of gender or sexuality. The abuse can encompass, but is not limited to, psychological, physical, sexual, financial and emotional. Since research showed that a relationship is more likely to turn abusive if one or both partners are young, the definition was extended to include 16 and 17-year-olds in March 2013. That change was brought in soon after stalking was officially made a criminal offence in November 2012. One of the groups on hand to help with cases of domestic abuse is Solace Women's Aid. I spoke to Cheryl Henry Leach, the current senior manager, to find out more about domestic abuse and the help provided by the group. I've come here to Solace Women's Aid in Islington, and I'm delighted to be joined by Cheryl Henry Leach. Talk to me about your background.
Okay, so I've been with Solace for just over 2 months now. Prior to that, I've been working within the domestic abuse sector up in South Yorkshire. So it's great that I've been able to join Solace. We provide a number of services throughout London to support women and girls impacted by domestic abuse and other issues linked to the Violence Against Women and Girls agenda, which is a national agenda which seeks to stop abuse from occurring.
Okay, so what does Solace do? Describe to me the role of the organisation.
Okay, so in terms of the services that we are currently providing within the communities, Waltham Forest being one of those areas. We provide advocacy and support services, which offer free confidential support to anyone aged 16 or over. So if anybody is feeling hurt or afraid of someone at home, then they can call us for help on 07340683382, or if it's an emergency, we'd ask that the police are called on 999. In terms of the support that you can access through Solace, that can be wide ranging, and it really does reflect what your needs are at the time that you approach us. But for example, some of the things we can help with would be around improving your safety in the home, supporting you with any housing related needs, potential homelessness. We do have refuge provision throughout the London area. We can also support with finances and welfare benefits, access to legal services. We can give support around parenting and children, and when other services are involved, support with appointments and advocacy in relation to that, and also the longer term emotional support. Once we've dealt with the immediate crisis, we do recognise that there's a need for recovery, and we provide lots of services around that through group work, which can be psychoeducational, therapeutic, so a raft of services that can be tapped into through Solace.
Domestic abuse, I can remember growing up in the 90s, and it was almost solely known as domestic violence between married partners or long-term partners, but the definition has become a lot more wide-ranging now, hasn't it?
It definitely has. And one of the things that we really do support in terms of the national definition is the inclusion of coercive and controlling behaviour. Because what we do know from survivors of domestic abuse, that violence is just one form of abuse that they are experiencing, and it interlinks with a number of other behaviours that are abusive, particularly around mind games. And what we do know is that where domestic violence or sexual violence is a feature of the pattern of abuse, then that's usually used to enforce control within the dynamic of the relationship. So, for example, what we do know is that abuse can be physical, sexual, emotional, or financial. It can take place within an intimate or family relationship, and the abuse can include neglect, controlling behaviour, forced marriage, so-called honour abuse, female genital mutilation, and that would be interlinked with physical violence and also sexual violence.
Stalking was officially made an offence in November 2012. Does that count as a form of domestic abuse, or is it separate? Now, what is interesting here is that if a woman is stalked by, or if a person is stalked by somebody they know, it's referred to as a domestic, but it hasn't happened within the context of a home. By definition, that person is being stalked everywhere they go. Now, I sense that the use of the word domestic is potentially misleading and troubling, because it leads you to believe that it's abuse and violence that's happening within the household, but it's not the case, is it?
Speaking specifically around stalking, what we do know is that it is an intrusive form of abuse that can cover every aspect of the victim's life. We do have cases where stalking is a feature within relationships, but also post-separation. We also have cases where there is relationship-based stalking, so by someone they know, not necessarily an intimate partner or ex-partner or family member. Yes, you are quite right. It can be considered a form of domestic abuse. And actually, based on our experience, what we do see is that where controlling behaviour or coercive control has been a feature during the relationship, it's likely to become stalking activity should the relationship end, or the perpetrator becomes aware that the victim is seeking support.
Yes, I mean, that leads nicely on to another point. It's often the case that the first few incidents look like stalking, but they fall slightly short of it, although there is no legal definition for stalking. And then from there, it does become stalking. And I sense it's the same with domestic abuse. It starts with a few activities that, again, fall slightly short of the legal definition, and then it becomes that, exactly.
Well, what we do know from our work with survivors of stalking, domestic abuse, domestic violence, what we do know is that they frequently tell us that something hasn't felt right within the relationship forming, so the very early stages of the relationship. And it's not unusual for us to dismiss that in terms of getting to know our new partner and seeing how the relationship develops. So what we would suggest is that if something's not feeling right, then seek advice, and the number that we've just given can help in terms of you talking through what doesn't feel right, so that you can determine whether or not your relationship is abusive in a safe and confidential forum. You said that there is no legal definition of stalking, and that's quite right. There isn't a legal definition of stalking, but that enables us to look at the patterns of behaviour so that we are able to ensure that any safety planning or security measures align with the pattern of abuse. So we're not just focusing on incidents of physical violence, we're looking at patterns, and that's exactly the same approach that we undertake now with coercive control. So we're looking at patterns of abuse where physical violence could be a feature of part of a wider pattern of other abusive behaviours. So there's lots of interlink and interlap in terms of the abuse, but the fundamental for us here at Solace is that every kind of abuse should be challenged and never tolerated. And we know that when you want to escape, that can be really hard to do. So that's why it's so important that we are here, and we are here to give that support.
So what are the common complaints that are reported to Solace Women's Aid?
Well, at a national level, there's been more than 75,000 domestic abuse offences and over 17,000 rapes and sexual assaults in just the past year. We know that women across London and Waltham Forest, being one of those areas, are experiencing domestic and sexual violence right now. And we work with those women so that they can live safe lives and have stronger futures. We've supported over 11,000 women and children across London in the past year, from crisis intervention right through to recovery and rebuilding and independence.
So what constitutes an abusive relationship?
Okay, so what constitutes a relationship will vary from relationship to relationship, but based on the research, based on the evidence that's out, the evidence base that we work to within the domestic abuse sector, what I can say is that if you are finding that you are in a relationship where there are rules and not norms, so the rules are where you have to comply with somebody's demands, and if you don't comply, then there's a consequence or punishment attached to that, compared to norms which are agreed freely, they're agreed mutually, and they make life with your partner bearable and livable. So that's the subtle difference around when a relationship is abusive or where it's not abusive. That probably oversimplifies the abusive dynamic that can develop within intimate relationships or family relationships that are abusive, but it gives a snapshot in terms of how do I know if I'm a victim of domestic abuse? And usually one of the first things I ask, you know, is if you don't comply with the demand, what happens? What's the consequence for that? And if the answer is that they know that they're either going to be hit or that there is a punishment attached to that, then we do consider what support we need to put in place to kind of redress that and ensure that the victim is safe.
What are the telltale signs of domestic abuse that outsiders can pick up on? And what are the common indicators that if somebody sees it, they should probably notify the authorities?
Okay, beyond the physical indicators, so the bruising, the black eyes, what we do see are victims and children who are showing differences in terms of personality. So you may have a friend who you're not seeing and has become quite isolated, and if you do have contact with them, their partner always seems to be present. You could have somebody who you are working with who is very keen to get home, because if they don't get home within prescribed timescales, then they're likely to have those consequences that we've just discussed earlier. You could be concerned about your daughter or son's new partner in terms of their background, and something just doesn't fit right. But actually, you don't want to be an over-intrusive parent, but you do want to be sure that your child is safe, regardless of how old they are. And so we do have other initiatives in place, such as the Domestic Abuse Disclosure Scheme that can be accessed through the police. If you are concerned about a child or somebody who is a vulnerable adult, then you can access support through your local authority. So Waltham Forest do have duty social workers, both in adult safeguarding but also in child safeguarding, who can give some advice and pointers in terms of what other support is out there. Also, victims can self-refer to Solace Women's Aid, and the bulk of our referrals are self-referrals. And the main thing is, for us as an organisation, there is the support out there if you want it.
Talk to me a bit more about mind games. How common are mind games?
I would say, based on my own experience from case management, extremely common. You're unlikely to have a abusive dynamic without any form of mind games present. So one of the things that I do see quite frequently in case management or casework is where the victim will say that the distortion isn't, that the reality is quite distorted. So in an extreme case, we've had women who've said, you know, that their partners have convinced them that apples are orange and not green, and that's the distortion, and that's a very extreme form of controlling behaviour. But it becomes normalised when you're living with abuse day in, day out. And that's why we at Solace firmly believe that it isn't acceptable, and you can live your life free of abuse.
The relationship is most likely to turn violent when the woman tries to leave. So that leaves women who are in domestic abuse, where it's perhaps a non-violent relationship, that leaves them in an impossible situation. How do you break that vicious cycle? How do you stop that wheel from turning?
So there is a very strong correlation between domestic abuse, separation, and domestic homicide. We do know from research, but also from the cases that we manage, that separation, particularly where you are leaving an abuser, is the most riskiest time for women and children. In terms of how we break that cycle, we always work from a safety first approach. So we will work with somebody for as long as they need us to work with them in terms of addressing their safety. We also know that for some women, the reality is that they will be remaining with their abuser. Again, we're looking at that safely. If there are children living in the household, then we are working with other agencies who can support the children. In terms of how we break the cycle, it's very much a bespoke response that's led very much by service user voice to rebuild their recovery and help them to identify how they can break the cycle in a safe way.
When a woman is pregnant, that's also a time when a relationship is likely to turn violent. What's the sort of support that Solace Women's Aid can provide for pregnant women trying to escape domestic abuse?
Well, we will support any woman who's trying to escape domestic abuse, regardless of whether they're pregnant or not. One of the things that we are doing in Waltham Forest is that we are supporting the Ask Me programme, which basically looks at safe points within the community where you can make a disclosure. You know that your confidentiality isn't going to be breached in any way, and you can access support there. So that could be anything from a hairdresser or nail salon right up to attending an A&E appointment, a maternity or midwifery appointment. So the support is there. What we do know is that victims of domestic abuse tell us that where they are pregnant, in 30% of the cases where domestic abuse has been a feature prior to the pregnancy, it becomes violent once and the violence happens within the first trimester. So again, it's a risky time for a victim of domestic abuse, and their focus is on how they can keep themselves and their unborn child safe, when actually they should be focusing on the nice things about a pregnancy and a new life coming into the world. So for us, we will provide that support for women. We will always provide it in a safe environment, we will ensure that we are working with partner agencies so they are aware of the abusive dynamic and what a safe approach looks like in terms of working with the victim.
Cheryl, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
I'm joined now by Robina and Councillor Karen Bellamy.
Hello.
Hello.
Firstly, Karen, talk to me a bit about your background. What do you do now for Waltham Forest Council?
Right, I've been a councillor for 8 years, and I'm currently chair of a scrutiny panel which looks at crime and community safety in the borough.
So you both have yourselves survived domestic violence and very bravely coming on the air to talk about your experiences. I saw you both nodding at several points during Cheryl's interview. How do you respond to it?
For me, I'm really pleased to hear that we have so many services available. So I had no idea. I have, in terms of women regularly coming to me and asking me for advice. And, you know, even now, I'm not aware of all these sort of facilities. And I know one of the main barriers for women in difficult situations is knowing that they have a shelter or a place of refuge to go to. So that's great to see. But I just wanted to pick up on one of the things that was said there in terms of signs tend to be shown early on in relationships. And, you know, that can well be the case. But in my personal experience, I lived with an individual for over a decade in a perfectly good, you know, environment. And then something changed. So I think it's important to highlight that, you know, for me, I think that's what clouded the situation. And it was difficult to recognise that actually this is unacceptable behaviour, because you think, well, they've been good for such a long time, you know, this is not them. And you almost, I didn't identify what was going on until, you know, quite late in the situation, really. So I think it's important to sort of say that unacceptable, abusive, controlling behaviour can come at any point in a relationship.
And seemingly out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. One point that I saw Karen nodding at was the discussion about the mind games.
Yeah.
Does that ring bells?
Very much so. In my relationship, there was a lot of mind games going on. Jewellery going missing and stuff like that. And me being told that basically, oh, you've lost it. It wasn't that I'd lost it at all. It was being given to other people. But then when you're in that situation, you're so... to me, domestic violence is like an onion. It just peels layers and layers and layers of your personality and yourself away. And I talk a lot to young girls about recognise it in early stages, around control, around things like, where have you been, meeting you from school? It could be meeting you from college. In my case, it was meeting me from work. And, you know, asking who I'd been speaking to, and me coming out of work and trying to say I hadn't spoken to anybody, or going home and being, if you like, interrogated. And then if he'd met me from work and someone had said that I looked nice as they were coming out, oh, you look nice, when I got home my clothes would have been torn up. So it was like real mind games and real control, absolute control, because you ended up quite scared about working and what you were going to wear, where you were going to be, who might be coming out of work when you were coming out of work. So it becomes, over time, all-encompassing.
Mm-hmm. Robina just outlined how somebody can change from being the nicest husband in the world to someone who's really controlling. And when you experience mind games like that, one of the problems can be that you try and rationalise the irrational. So you think, one, why has this person suddenly changed? Or, as is Karen's case, why is this person treating me like this? What have I done to deserve this? Whereas actually, it is baseless and it is irrational. And then that adds another layer of being driven mad. Another layer of control is when you try to rationalise it and you try to come up with a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to say that abuse and violence doesn't look at your colour, your level of intelligence, your upbringing, your class, your wealth. You know, it will, you know, impact you regardless. And it doesn't mean just because you're from a certain background that you're better able to necessarily deal with it or even identify it. You know, I'm somebody who's been to university. I feel like, you know, looking back, I would have thought I was somebody who would have picked it up a lot quicker and responded a lot quicker. But, you know, that's not the case. And I think it's important not to feel a failure and not to feel that you've done something wrong, but just recognizing that abuse, control comes in so many shapes and forms. And I think we all grow up with this kind of stereotype of thinking that when we see it, we will recognize it. And it's often hidden and often done in such a way that the victim, the person who's going through it, won't recognize it until actually the event is probably, you're quite deep in, or it's even done and dusted.
Yeah, you sleepwalk your way into it.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, one of the problems I think is that just because it's non-violent and it's not physical, people don't know when their relationship is in fact abusive. Was that the case for either of you?
I just wanted to say that in the women that I come across today, I have so many ladies and friends approach me, and I think my situation was very similar, is that when you are dealing with a partner who is having an affair, if you like, or doing something, you know, that's not appropriate within the marriage, people then fail to see the abuse and the negative, unacceptable behaviour that that individual is putting their other half through, and it becomes labelled as an extramarital affair, and the abuse gets neglected. And you almost, as the person going through it as well, you know, can't see that that's happening to you because you're so focused on this is a clear-cut case of somebody cheating on you. But, you know, there's a lot more complexity there, and I think a lot of women are in abusive situations and they're not getting the support because it's being labelled as a situation as that's just simply an affair. And I think we need to have these discussions, have these talks, and people need to be able to stand up and support women when they turn to them and not simply just say, look, it's, you know, it's clear cut, it's an affair, you walk out, or, you know, you try and fix the marriage.
Yeah, I'd like to say that also in that interview they spoke about looking out for bruises on people. I was abused physically, but there was never any visible bruises that you would see. When I went to work into the office, nobody would see it because they would be on my body, they wouldn't be on my face or anywhere that was uncovered. So I think it's sort of a bit stereotyping that, you know, somebody's going to walk in with a black eye. Not necessarily the case at all. And I think we also need to look at, going forward, young girls that are being abused, very young girls, 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds, that are being abused within gang culture, which you just know that we've had the report come out. And unfortunately in casework, I see this coming forward now, that young girls 15, 16 are being controlled by young boys in quite violent ways, but also in very emotional ways where they're almost being blackmailed into doing things that they don't want to do, and it's actually quite worrying.
Do you think that that's got a lot more rife in more recent years with texting and instant communication, because people can just be got hold of like that?
I think social media has a lot to do with the control that young people now, young, it could be men or women, but the casework I've dealt with is young girls, where through social media they may have photographs, they may have whatever, and that is held as a bargaining tool. And obviously that can then be, it's like revenge porn or whatever, it can be put out there immediately and very quickly, and as we know, it's very, you can't retrieve it. Once it's out there, it's out there. So I think in my day there was no social media, but now I think it's almost so immediate that young girls can be, a photograph is taken in whatever situation, and then
they're blackmailed.
Then exactly, then they've got this tool that they can use. And it's again, we go back to mind games, and that's where it comes from.
How much of it is peer pressure?
I don't know. I wouldn't comment on that. I mean, I think that there are young men now are, if you look around, a lot of the young men that we deal with in the borough that are saying gangs, there is a lot of peer pressure because they've got to be shown to be in control, they've got to be shown to be strong, and I've spoken to a couple of women, and I don't think their sons particularly want to do that, but again, it could be peer pressure. For the young girls, it's peer pressure, as I said. I think it's more about control.
Well, that's really worrying that it's happening at a young age, because Rabina just pointed out that you can sleepwalk your way into abuse, not knowing what it is, and then suddenly it becomes the norm, and then suddenly it's your life. So these young people just getting swallowed into it at a young age.
Absolutely. I mean, I've got to say, the cases that I've dealt with, the police have been really helpful, and we've had quite a good response from statutory services. But the fact that you have 15, 16-year-old girls out there that are basically terrified, and they're going through exams or whatever, which that sort of pressure while you're trying to do your exams could actually ruin their results there. And so that sort of continues forward into their life. They don't get the results they want. They don't get the university they want, you know, and it just goes on and on and on. But as I say, to me, the emotional thing is like stripping away slowly, and I've done talks in schools and colleges around basically young girls recognising this, that when somebody says, oh, I want to show me your phone, I want to, you know, and they go through the phone and they think, oh, they're doing that because they love me, they really care about me. No, they're doing that because they want to control you, and it's that sort of thing. And you know, pulling you away from your friends, as you've mentioned, and meeting you at school, trying to sort of monopolise what you do. Very young girls see that as, oh, he's really into me, he really loves me, blah, blah, blah. And I give talks about saying, actually, no, you need to be very careful because he's trying to control you.
Yes, you need your own personal space.
Yeah.
And are girls, many girls, but young people who are more likely to fall victims to that, are they more likely to be ones from families where domestic abuse is happening, or is it all very private, sort of secret life of teenagers stuff?
I think it's secret life of teenagers, and I wouldn't say that a lot of the young women that I've dealt with, they don't come from families where domestic abuse is an issue. Mm-hmm. It's not been. I think it is sometimes, because if you've seen it as a child or a young person, if you go into a relationship like that, it feels familiar, yes. You know. So yeah. It's not so, what is that? But I think we couldn't generalise and say that it's a lot. Domestic violence is a very, very mixed bag. It might be somebody who's a chief executive. It might be somebody who's a builder. It might be somebody who's unemployed. It could be a teacher, a doctor. It's right across the board. I think domestic violence is classless. It's colourblind.
Mm-hmm. And Rabina, you had children with your abusive husband, didn't you?
Yeah.
I remember you say that you felt quite guilty about wanting to end the marriage.
I think you accept unacceptable behaviour. Because you think, I'm doing it for their benefit. Mm-hmm. I'm saving something for them, their home.
And for the sake of a marriage that you've worked so hard for.
Yeah. And then obviously, you know, thankfully with me, there came a point where I said to myself, you know, what example am I setting my children? I wouldn't want them to accept this kind of behaviour or deal with another human being in this manner. But then, you know, I had that moment. I had that awakening. Not everybody, you know, has that moment. And I think with children, in my case, I had no sort of physical, you know, abuse. It was behaviours that were manipulative, controlling, knocking away at my confidence, making me feel that I'm not good enough, I'm a failure. So it was almost sort of through the back door abuse, which I didn't even know it was happening till I'm in that situation.
The guilt is a product of the control, because it's irrational guilt. Nobody should have to stay with an abusive partner. It's another layer of the coercion.
Yeah, and I think what's dangerous is when it's presented to you in an articulate, intelligent, calm, almost polite manner, and that's what makes it dangerous, because you don't recognise it.
Mm-hmm. You don't recognise it, but I think it's really important to remember that, one, nobody should put up with abuse, and no one should feel guilty for wanting to get away from abuse, and also, it can happen to anyone. It's an equal opportunities destroyer. It's classless. It happens across cultural boundaries. And there's just no excuse for it.
No. And then there's lots of, you know, there's so many barriers in terms of addressing those situations and getting out of those situations. One of the things for me, I'm sure cultural barriers come in all shapes and forms across all faiths. But for me, being a Muslim woman, I had, you know, you had pressure from within family and friends, try and save it, you know, for the sake of the kids, for the sake of your religion. You then have, for me, my, you know, once if I was going to leave, pursuing a civil separation and a divorce did not, was not my be all and end all for me in the eyes of God. Leaving this marriage was my big sort of wall that I had to climb, and in order to do that, I wanted to speak to people and get advice and seek guidance from people who are sort of knowledgeable in my faith. And that's what I found to be the biggest barrier. I'm somebody who studied Sharia law, and I thankfully was able to challenge the incorrect and absolutely appalling advice that I was getting from many sort of Sharia councils that are set up across the borough, without sort of licensing, without any kind of qualification, and tend to be male dominated and more so cultural views rather than anything that's founded out of Islam, and being told that certain behaviors are acceptable, or you have to make an effort before you walk, or you know, he can do XYZ and there's not a lot you can do about it, and that's complete rubbish. And but with me, thankfully, I was able to not just take the first piece of rubbish advice and follow it. I was able to think, no, knock on another door, or actually say, no, well, I've read the Quran, I've read, you know, so I can challenge it. But then how many women who, you know, are in a position where they don't challenge it, or they don't knock on the right door? And I know, you know, it's across faiths, you know.
I think the answer to that question is a lot, because they think, oh, it must be something I've done. I'm guilty of something here. And as we were saying, you know, you work really hard, you want your marriage to work, and then they feel like they can't get away. Karen, you want to come in?
I mean, different faith, Roman Catholic. When I went to our priest and said that I wanted to get a divorce because of what was going on, I was told, well, I should stick at it. And that actually, if I do get a divorce, in the eyes of God, I would never be divorced. And in the eyes of the Catholic Church, I would never be divorced. I would always be married to the abuser. And that then sort of ended my relationship with the church. I did go and get a divorce.
These are both more forms of coercion that I'm hearing from you. It's more sort of domestic abuse, but not between people who know each other.
Yeah. I mean, I was really surprised. Because I'd done a lot for the church, and when I went to speak to the priest, he knew what was going on anyway, and I was just really shocked that, having had the talks with him and everything else, that when I finally was going to go for the divorce, that's what I got. And I just found that really shocking and unsupportive, obviously.
Were you surprised that they were both so unsympathetic?
Definitely.
I was stunned. I was lucky in the end. I found a practice, an imam, that actually was very good and applied what I've read from the Quran. But that was me being lucky and finding someone. And I'd knocked on several doors before I got to this one. And that's what worries me, is instead of giving you support and help to either resolve a situation or find a way out of it, you're actually told no, you can't do anything, or you have to make it work, or you have to accept that kind of behaviour.
So is there still a stigma of wanting to end a marriage and wanting to get away?
I would say I feel like in the last decade I've seen an improvement in the community and the people that I see in my day-to-day life. That said, I could see the minute I was divorced the difference in how I was treated. And I used to say I almost felt like I was rubbish on people's shoes, because you could see that you were not greeted at a social gathering like you were had you turned up with your other half. You were not invited to certain things. You just weren't given the respect that you had previously. But you know, for me, it was an eye-opening experience in terms of you kind of. I mean, I don't judge these people, because I say it's difficult for somebody to understand. You know, if you haven't walked through hot coals, you're not going to know what it's like. So at the same time, I try. You know, if somebody who's treated me like that in the past and I see them, you know, I'm always still respectful. And I think what's happened with time is that you as an individual have to just find your way and find your strength. And once you show people that actually I can still be successful, I'm still living my life, I'm still bringing up my children, I'm holding down a job, that respect comes back naturally. But that shouldn't be the case. It shouldn't be that you have to go through that struggle and carry on and be a success to be able to have that respect. You should always have that basic respect there, regardless of whether you're married, single or divorced. And that's something that's a society kind of big issue that I don't know if we'll ever manage to fix.
Karen, you've mentioned effects on your physical health, the bruising in areas that where you'd have clothes over. Can I ask, did you have any other effects on your physical health?
Yes, I had several physical effects. I can't have children now because of an injury that I got. So, yeah, it's difficult. It was, as I said, it was abuse that you couldn't see. It was a lot of emotional, financial, just control. You know, I stopped working because he wanted me to stop working. He wrote the resignation letter. You know, I was in a really good job at the time. I'm in a really good job now. I'm a CEO. So it's, it's hard. But I think that we have to be aware that not everything is like you see on the TV. There are elements of little bits of what you might see in a documentary, or you might see in a film or something. But for each individual, it's different, and it can be extreme. It can be light touch, but it doesn't matter how that is. The individual is still struggling. So, I think abusers are very clever. As we've said, they're very manipulative. So a lot of them that are clever, you won't see bruises on women or men. They will be in places that you're not going to see, and that is because, you know, to all intents and purposes, on the street and in front of family and friends, they're very charming. I mean, people didn't know about my abuse. My mother knew, my father didn't know, my mother knew. In one incident, she came in and got her fingers broken, three of her fingers, and basically went home and got the dog and took the dog out for a walk, and then came back and said to my dad that the dog had pulled her over and that she'd have to go to hospital so that he wouldn't know. So there's also sometimes members within the family that collude to hide the abuse, and that is, in a way, good, because you feel like you're being supported. I mean, I felt that my mum was really supporting me, and God bless her, she did. But she was also, if you like, helping him to continue the level of abuse that he was doing by covering it up.
And effects on your mental health?
I would say that it was quite detrimental. I'm not frightened to say that I ended up in therapy. And I had a year where I had agoraphobia, so I couldn't go outside the house, got terrified of everything and anything, and when he left, I got therapy, and then went on to train as a counsellor and psychotherapist because I wanted to find out what it was and why I had, if you like, accepted that behaviour. So I wanted to work it out for myself psychologically, what was behind that. To be fair to Mum, she's not with me now, she thought she was doing the right thing. She thought that, and my dad was very ill, so we knew that if he found out, he obviously, I'm an only child, so, and you know, he put me on a pedestal. His daughter was, you know, the best daughter in the world. If he knew what was going on, we were scared that it would kill him sooner than, I mean, he died at 56 anyway, but we were worried that that would sort of hasten that. So that was one of the reasons that we covered it up.
And Robina, what about your family dynamic? How was that affected by your abusive relationship and subsequent divorce?
I was just going to pick up on the health side of things if I may. In terms of health, I think mentally, I'm somebody who copes, I don't want to say what the right word is, but I coped well with the pressures that I was under, and it actually came out in me physically. And not having experienced that before, I didn't realise that mental stress can come out in you physically. So I went to my GP in a sort of, I think, 2.5 week period, 4 times with extreme chest pains, to the point where I'd actually asked for a nurse to examine me because I was saying I must have a lump in my chest, there must be something there. And I remember not being able to move my right side of my head and my shoulder and my arm. And I always look back and I think I was maybe close to having a stroke. I don't know what it was, but the GP, I remember him sitting me down and saying, you've turned up this many times, we can't find anything, is there anything else going on in your life? And he was able to obviously connect, you know, I told him what's happening at home, so those events with the physical pain, and say stress can manifest physically. But also just to say then that in my case, I was really failed by this GP, because this GP then went on to say that I shouldn't leave my husband because he'll commit suicide. He also then went on to actually forcibly give me a prescription of sleeping pills, because I had told him I was having extreme trouble sleeping. And he was saying to me that you cannot continue like this with no sleep. You know, it will affect you at some point. You won't be able to function anymore. So I remember walking out, binning the prescription, because I've grown up in a family where I saw my mother on antidepressants and sleeping tablets, and I thought that's not something I want to go down that route. So I walked away, and I was able to say to myself, acknowledge that my stress is impacting my health, and then try and say, okay, that's the bit when I woke up and said, right, I need to take actions now, because the fact that I couldn't dress my little girl, put her top over her, woke me up. And I think that was my turning point. And I realised, this individual is not worth my health, and my children not being able to have a mother that functions. But just going back to the point about the GP, I think I know we've spoken to a GP for this programme. It's really important that people are able to go to their GPs and not be put off by what I've said. I think maybe I'm hoping I was unlucky and it was a one-off, and it's a GP that I know has since been struck off for other reasons. But I think the point that I wanted to make partly today is that when people go to experts, GPs, lawyers, regardless, I was failed even by lawyers, so on many accounts, and I think my point is that don't take experts as being Bible in what they're saying. Always challenge what they say, verify what they say, maybe go to one or two other people, and because experts are just as the rest of us, they are human and they can make mistakes.
So you had to knock on a lot of doors, didn't you, before you got any sense out of anyone?
Yeah.
In the interview that I did with Cheryl, you heard her talking about the Ask Me programme with community ambassadors. What do you make of that? Is it something you wished had been around at the time? Because it's a new scheme, it's still in the making.
I think it's a good thing. I think if we go back 27 years was when mine ended, I don't know that it would have sat well then, because society's changed so much. And I think now we're much more open, we're much more willing to not be judgmental. But I think then you would have still had a problem. I mean, you know, you cover it up. I covered it up because I was ashamed. And as you said earlier, you get this feeling that I must have done something wrong. It must be me. You know, why is everybody else in my family okay? And, you know, I've got this rubbish marriage. And it must be something that I've done. And now I think it's much different. That I think lots of women, not saying young girls, but women, would be that know that it's not acceptable, it's not their fault. And I think the Ask Me thing is going to be a good thing.
Okay. And what about the RISE Perpetrator Programme?
The Perpetrator Programme is where RISE goes into the home and they will assess whether they think there's a possibility that the perpetrator can stay within the family. And then they will ask whether that's what the family want to do. And it's consensual, so it's not something that's forced on anybody. They ask the perpetrator if they want to change their behaviour. And if they do, then we can refer them, or RISE can refer them, and they can get counselling and CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, to change their ways and bring them back into the family. Because the thinking behind it is that it's better to keep a family together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you both been able to trust men since this happened to you?
I'll be honest, that's one of my biggest challenges.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I meet individuals and, you know, they are trustworthy, but to trust someone to start and share your life with and your children's home with, that's just, I just don't see how that will happen. That said, I don't think it's impossible. I live in hope. And you know, and I don't think all men are, you know, bad. You know, there's some very good men out there. But yeah, it's definitely, we talked earlier about scars. That's probably for me my long-term impact. For that individual, he's moved on, he's able to have a new relationship and plan, you know, his future life with somebody. Whereas for me, there's always a question of, can I trust this individual? Will they do the same thing?
For me, I moved on. I've been married for, this year it'll be 25 years, and basically he's one of the nicest men you could meet. They're not, so I need to put it out there that, you know, not all men are like this. He's somebody that I would say, he doesn't think so, but I think he helped put me back together. So there are good men out there.
Great. Well, thank you very much, ladies, for speaking on the air. It's not easy. Thank you very much. It's really appreciated.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Now, as you'd expect, the first people who respond to a domestic abuse incident when it's reported are the police. But often, those who identify it before that stage are doctors, GPs and medical professionals. Here I am speaking to Dr. Sabina Farangi about the role that doctors can play in tackling domestic violence and domestic abuse. I'm here in Chingford and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sabina Farangi.
Hello.
And you are the named GP for Child and Adult Safeguarding in Waltham Forest. Tell me about your background and experience.
So I started my career in the NHS at the age of 18, doing a vocational training in theatre nursing. I then went to medical school in the Czech Republic in Prague before coming back to the UK to start my internship as a foundation year doctor and then following a path in general practice. I completed my general practice in 2014 and have been working as a GP since. Initially, I was working as a GP and an A&E doctor for a year before moving into child safeguarding and then subsequently taken on the role of adult safeguarding lead in Waltham Forest.
So doctors are central to the identification, safety and referral of domestic violence and abuse survivors. And this is because the victims are more likely to open up to a doctor or a healthcare professional than anyone else. So this puts the doctors on the front lines of reducing the problem. How does the problem of domestic abuse manifest itself? What are the common signs?
So it can be quite difficult to pick up on an initial consultation because often people don't come in and say, I'm experiencing domestic abuse at home. First, they want to build up a relationship with that health practitioner. So it might be a practice nurse. It could be the doctor at the surgery. Or some GP surgeries have pharmacists now who do consultations for minor ailments and will do medication reviews. So it's about firstly building up that rapport and feeling that once you've made that disclosure, you feel safe to. Now, often there may be repeated discharge summaries that we have from A&E that show numerous attendances to the A&E department with injuries. So if you're looking through the notes, potentially you could pick that up and say, right, that this patient has had a lot of A&E attendances. The other thing is coming in with very non-specific symptoms, aches, pains, headaches, muscle aches, abdominal pain. And on investigation, we're not really finding anything. So that's what we know as somatization. But that's, it's a very real pain. It's not belittling it, but it's a manifestation of what is going on deeper.
The way in which domestic abuse commonly presents itself to a GP, is it something that patients are open and honest about, or is it something that the doctor has got to really look for?
Sometimes patients are waiting to be asked how everything is, waiting to be asked. With the limitations of the GP consultation, sometimes we get so focused on the problem, potentially, that although we're not asking in a way that may present itself for the patient to open up and say, this is going on at home. However, saying that, once a patient has built up a rapport with a practitioner, they may feel more comfortable to disclose because that relationship is there. Now, your question was, how does it present? On personal experience, some patients tell me. I've had a patient come in and say, I think I'm being gaslighted. I've had another patient, I remember, who was pregnant, and I was dipping the urine and I said, oh, how are you? How's everything at home? And she just burst out into tears. That pregnant lady had seen many health practitioners. She'd had her antenatal screening, which screens for domestic violence, but she had never disclosed up until the point that I'd said, how are you? Maybe she felt ready at that point. Maybe that burden and that she was carrying was too much to hold on her own. And she was ready. So I think it's a bit of both. One, do you ask in a truly caring way, or in a way that you truly want to receive the answer? And two, is the patient ready to disclose? And often it's the environment, the tone of your voice, your demeanour. And there's lots of limiting factors for healthcare professionals, whether it's a GP or whether it's a nurse or whether in your own hospital. And that could be if you're running late, if you're overbooked, if you've got an emergency, your own personal mitigating family situations that may be clouding how your day runs, so you don't come across as open or as ready to receive their problem. So that could potentially be a barrier. Now, the training that is being delivered is asking healthcare practitioners to question that and to reflect on that. Because actually, if any healthcare practitioner thought they were being perceived that way, I'm sure they feel horrified, and it is never something that they'd want to be perceived as being, you know, that there's a barrier to sharing information with them, because they're all healthcare practitioners. I've never come across one that wouldn't truly want to help someone or anyone that is in need of help and care.
So you mentioned pregnancy and the screening for ladies. How do the signs of domestic abuse differ between men, women and children?
Yes. So men, women and children, I think it's difficult. So with children, you might have behavioural issues that could be picked up in schools. So there may be a change of behaviour. There may be physical signs, so signs of fear. So they were previously continent and then they started bedwetting again. They don't want to be left alone. Their attention is poor in school. They have communication difficulties. They have difficulties forming friendships. So with women, it may be isolation. It may manifest as the word I mentioned before was somatization. So physical pain, but on investigation, there is nothing. There may be unexplained bruising if it's a physical physical. But then again, domestic violence is not just physical. We have to remember coercive control and emotional abuse, psychological abuse, and that will affect someone's confidence.
Over the years, has the frequency of domestic abuse disclosures to GPs increased? Is that something that practitioners have seen more of?
I can't answer from a statistical point of view because I don't know the figures. And the honest answer is I'm not sure. But I think if practitioners are looking and asking for the right questions at the right times, then potentially, and giving patients the opportunities. So, for example, in a depression consultation or when depression's identified during the antenatal visits and screenings, potential causes, or even having that discussion with them, say, if there is nothing at the time, saying, we know that domestic abuse can potentially go up during pregnancy. But also for men, it's harder for them to come forward, I think, in many cases, for fear of not being believed, for potentially feeling emasculated by what is going on, and embarrassment, which there should never be, because no one, no victim should ever feel that way. It is not their fault. But actually, there may be these barriers there. So I don't know the figures, but I believe with training on how to investigate and inquire, that potentially you will see more disclosures.
Are perpetrators known to ever approach a doctor about their wrongdoing?
I do believe perpetrators have spoken to doctors because they do feel guilty, because they want to help. They might not straight away come out with, you know, I am being violent in an emotional, psychological, physical way towards my partner, but it may manifest as, my temper's out of control, or I'm drinking more, or I'm more irritable. And on probing, you may find that they actually are having more arguments with their partner. And that argument then may have a physical aspect or a psychological damaging aspect to it. In which case, we can signpost the perpetrator and potentially the victim as well. And we can talk about relationship counselling, and we can talk about their individual needs as well as their couple needs.
Can a doctor identify a perpetrator? And if so, what would and should a medic's response be?
So this builds on previously what we were talking about. So can you say for sure someone is a perpetrator? Unless they confess, or you or the victim is coming in saying, I don't believe you can. But if you've got someone coming in with anger management issues, substance misuse issues, depression, where they're irritable, and ask them and probe and be curious about what is going on at home. Do not just stop at the first, so I'm a bit irritable. Find out how that manifests, and that will lead to reveal more. And again, then you can refer for counselling, for perpetrator, for victim. You can refer for family therapy if there's children involved, early help, because this has a rippling effect. It's not just the two people. And actually, also the other thing we need to remember about domestic abuse, it might not just be between partners. It can be from extended family towards someone else coming into the home.
As a GP, you're more likely to get complaints of bad temper, needing anger management, than you are outright confessions of domestic abuse. So what does the GP training for confronting domestic abuse look like in Waltham Forest? I understand that we don't have the IRIS programme in this borough, and that that's largely due to funding and lack of continuity.
Although we don't have the IRIS, which is also known as IRIS Project, Waltham Forest CCG, which is a clinical commissioning group, does provide domestic violence training and updates for our GPs, where we talk about cases, where we invite people from projects such as the IRIS Project and Solace Women's Aid and the local authority to come and talk to our GPs, to come and present cases, to do active work with them, to empower them, to recognise and signpost and support the victims and the perpetrators.
Where could improvements be made to the training provided to GPs for dealing with victims of domestic abuse?
I think funding is always improved funding. You know, the more if we have funding, then we can support projects such as the IRIS project to support us, actually. This is one example. But you, saying that, you don't necessarily need an IRIS project in order to have a good support network, but you do need the funds to be able to provide services and advocates and refuges and counselling for both victims, perpetrators, extended family who are feeling the rippling effects of domestic violence.
What are the sort of telltale signs that you're told to look for as a GP?
So I don't know if there's any specific telltale signs. We always say, ask the patient how they are. We always say, ask them how they are. We always say, look in the notes to see if there's a trend, because you have the benefit as a GP of holding all those records, looking at the A&E records to see if you can see any patterns. If it's if there's depression or mood that's affected, inquire. Are you drinking more? What's happening at home? Are you arguing with your spouse more? Or who lives at home with you? Oh, you live with your parents-in-law. Or, oh, how's that relationship? Is it supportive? And often things come out slowly that way. And you might get some breadcrumbing initially. And that's the patient maybe trying to see if they can trust you. And then you might get more disclosed. But it's not something that comes out in one go. It's something that takes time. We know that generally, I think the approximate figure is there's 35 encounters with health before a victim will disclose. But again, it's about building up trust. It's about building up the courage for that victim to actually say, things aren't okay and I want and I need help.
Would you encourage somebody listening to this who is uncertain whether or not their relationship is abusive to talk to their GP? What message would you give that person?
I would always say, if you're unsure, or even if you are sure, go speak to your GP, go and speak to your practice nurse. Book a double appointment if you think it's going to be a longer consultation, because then they'll have the time to sit there and talk to you without you feeling rushed as well. Talking, sharing your concerns, your fears always helps. And then we can signpost you, we can help you, we can direct you. And what we want to do, as I said before, is make you the strongest person you can be emotionally, so you can make a decision that is right for you. We want to give you your power. We want you to feel empowered about the decisions you are making, so you can live a safe, happy life. That is what we want. Because we know if you are living a safe, happy life and you are mentally strong, the likelihood of feeling chronic pain and physical ailments goes down. Because you might not be having this crampy abdominal pain that we call IBS, or these headaches that are due to stress, or these muscle aches because you're carrying tension in your shoulders. So being mentally strong, feeling safe, it goes back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs almost. You need a safe environment. You need a happy environment in order to thrive and flourish. And that is what we want. And if we can signpost you to help you achieve that, we will.
Dr. Sabina Farangi, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you. Have a good day.
So welcome back, Rabina and Karen. What did you think of the points that she made?
She was really good, very thorough. Seems like she's, you know, somebody who's very approachable, understanding. And I wish that she was the GP that I went to see.
Because you also said that there's certainly, when you were suffering, there wasn't enough publicity about the help that is on hand.
Yeah, one of the things that I think we need to make sure is that all these organisations are working together. So the health services, the police, you know, all these support mechanisms that are available, that they're made, the message is communicated consistently and across the piece, across the educational facilities, across our medical health services.
So that way they'll be stronger.
Yeah.
Karen?
Likewise, I wish she was around when I was going through my domestic abuse situation, and I would say that not all GPs are the same, even now. It's worth the survivor or the person that's going through it now thinking about what GP they go to. If they go to a GP and they don't get the advice that they think they should get, ask to see someone else in the practice. Because in my situation, I was told I was being neurotic, and would I like to go on to Valium and stuff like that. So, and I know that that still happens, that women are still prescribed sleeping pills or Valium or something like that for short, you know, at the beginning, it's short periods of time to sort of calm down, dear. So I think if you don't get the right advice in the first instance, try and see another GP in the practice.
So you mean it wasn't treated as a natural response to what was happening?
No.
Good.
No, I mean, look, we're going back probably, when I was disclosing this, we're going back 27 years ago. So, you know, the practice was dominated by male doctors. So you were going to see men who you were trying to talk about a situation with a man that was violent or controlling. And, I was told that, you know, I was probably a little bit neurotic, a little bit highly strung. You know, would you like to try and, you know, talk it over with him and take some Valium and see how you go and then come back and see me? So, yeah.
That surprises me because schizophrenia is described as a sane response to an insane situation.
Yeah.
So the fact that you were actually having that response of upset, maybe perceived hysteria and trauma would surely mean that you had managed to cling on to some of your sanity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, things have improved dramatically over the last few decades. I mean, the police response now to domestic violence is much different to how it was when I was going through it. When I was going through it, if the police turned up and I was obviously irate, then I've been threatened with arrest to calm down. If you don't calm down, we will arrest you. That's after being thrown over a garden wall. So, you know, not a high one, but, you know, about 3 foot high. So, you know, that was it. Calm down. If you don't calm down, we will arrest you. You don't get that now. The police are much more well-trained and much more on the ball. And as I said, in my casework, I deal with the police quite often. And I think that they're much better now than they were decades ago. So things have improved.
Probably with the depth of research that's been conducted.
That said, my experience was about, I was trying to work out six, seven years ago when the GP that I saw tried to prescribe me sleeping tablets and told me to stay within the marriage. I think it's a bit of hit and miss luck whether you get a good GP.
It just sounds like the GP was in denial that his patient needed any attention.
It's quite interesting because he actually asked me, he sat me down and said, what else is going on? And then I told him what else was going on. Then he decided to give me the advice that he thinks was, you know, best fit, which was clearly wrong.
GPs are, they will see people coming back for repeat visits with, like you said, chest pain, or they've got headaches or whatever, and if there's no actual physical cause, then basically then they should start looking at what else is going on within the person's life. But sometimes people that have got issues are very good at covering it up. And, you know, when I was a counsellor, it was sometimes the throwaway comment as people left the session that would tell you what they were actually wanted to present with. So I think it's quite difficult for GPs, but I also think that now the training is much better than it was back in the day, shall we say.
Because there's that old chestnut, isn't it, that you ask someone, oh, what's happened, what's that bruise there, and the response is, I fell.
Yeah.
I mean, injuries were all concealed by clothing, but did you have any sort of standard excuses and responses that you would give whenever somebody asked what was happening at home?
You just made an excuse if somebody heard anything. Oh, we were play fighting, or we were doing this, or we were doing that. You're very good. You become very adept at covering things up, because it's, for me, I felt, as I said earlier, I felt quite ashamed, and I couldn't understand why I was in that situation. You know, I was in a good job, I was, you know, a bright young woman, confident, I mean, I think I ended up a husk of what I was. Mm. People that now know, and after he left, said to me that we watched you change. We watched you become very insular, whereas I'm very sort of gregarious, very outgoing, that I became very insular, very quiet, sort of wouldn't say anything.
Reclusive.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so there are clues, but it's whether family, friends pick up on it, and if they do, then do you disclose to them? You know.
And these little excuses that are given, is that because the victim wants to convince other people or themselves?
I think it's a bit of both. I think you want to convince yourself that everything's going to be okay and that there's nothing particular going on. You know, it's just a normal marriage or relationship or whatever it is. Because the reality and the realisation that actually, you know, this is big and that this is whatever decisions I make now are going to change my whole life. Mm. I mean, I didn't have children. I know Rabina's got children, so it depends. Each relationship, each situation is individual and can be very, very different, even if it's a relationship that has no children or has children. Each person's perception and experience is different.
I think one of the key things that we've managed to tease out today in this discussion is that you have the coercive and controlling abuse within the home, and then you have other layers of that when you try and seek help or when you respond to it. So you have the guilt and the shame of wanting to get away from it, which is irrational and baseless, and so that adds another layer of being controlled. And then, as you've described, as victims, you are also controlled by family members and ministers and doctors. So it's four layers there that add more control. So that traps the victim further.
In my experience, I now look back and I was stunned that I had peers, friends who are educated, business-minded, successful, you know, careers, telling me not to divorce this individual or not to go through the courts. You will lose, you will walk away with nothing. And not because they had bad intentions or because they're bad people, it's just, I think, genuine ignorance, not knowing, not having experienced. And I look back and I think, thank God I didn't listen to these people.
Yeah, fact that there's only one of you is neither here nor there. That's ridiculous. Well, well done, ladies. Thank you very much once again for coming on the air and speaking about this very sensitive issue. And I'm very pleased that you got to a happier place.
Thank you. Yeah.
So what happens once domestic abuse has been made known to the authorities? I spoke to local police officer PC Georgina Lodge to find out. I'm here in Leighton and I'm delighted to be joined by PC Georgina Lodge.
Hello.
What's your background in dealing with safeguarding and domestic abuse?
I work for the Community Safety Unit here at Leighton Police Station, and I have done since February.
So what is the volume of domestic abuse in Waltham Forest? Domestic abuse makes up around 35% of recorded crime in the borough, which makes it a very high volume of crime. But how effective are the tools that you have in place to tackle it?
It varies, as does the individual seeking our assistance or the case. It's identified as the individual is identified as a needing assistance. We know from statistics that DA survivors, so domestic abuse survivors or victims, that it can take up to about 50 incidents prior to them asking for help or getting the police involved. The tools we have at our disposal range from enforcement, for example, our biggest power, which is the power of arrest, to engaging with support services. We're also currently piloting a scheme called Op and Compass, a disclosure process to schools where children who are identified as being in a home environment and potentially have witnessed domestic abuse, we disclose to the relevant school so that child can get the support they need, if that's at its lowest level in the school, just so the school are aware that the child may be more tired or may need some comfort with them during the day.
Can you give me an example of the types of cases that you deal with?
Okay.
When it comes to domestic abuse?
We could deal with a case from a very minor, low-level common assault to a case all the way up to attempted murder. We could deal with a criminal damage, harassment, any sort of offence where the victim and suspect have been in an intimate relationship, have lived within the same household, are family members.
And what about your responsibilities when it comes to investigating domestic abuse? What do they entail?
Our responsibilities entail initially safeguarding the victim, ensuring that they are being looked after, ensuring that they're not at risk of any further offences or trying to prevent that risk. We have responsibilities to gather all the evidence, to put the case before a lawyer, to review the case and decide whether it goes to court or if the perpetrator or the suspect is suitable for a caution or something like that. We have a responsibility to the perpetrator as well to try and identify why this has happened, if there are any underlying risks or issues with alcohol or drugs, financial issues, things like that, to try and prevent the cycle of domestic abuse.
So coercion and control were added to the list of behaviours in the definition of domestic abuse, but we've yet to see very many cases of those being investigated or charged. And why do you think that is?
Controlling coercing behaviour is a hidden offence. At face value, the individual that's the victim may not recognise that they are being controlled or coerced. Likewise, the first responders, the initial investigators, may not recognise that at the incident. A lot of the time, police will get a call to an assault or some sort of criminal damage or threats, and whilst there, it can become apparent that there are controlling and coercing behaviours within the relationship. So we're prompting, looking for the bigger picture, asking officers to ask the right questions so we can identify this behaviour.
And when it comes to collating evidence for prosecution, what sort of information is the most compelling?
There's nothing more compelling than a victim or a witness giving an account to the court with regards to what happened to them or what they saw. A person telling the facts in a court is probably the most powerful piece of evidence or piece of evidence you could get. The 999 call is often really powerful because, especially if somebody's been assaulted, the victim giving their first account to the controller when they call 999, it is really powerful if they are very emotional.
When it comes to safeguarding and risk management, what are you allowed to do to keep a victim or a family safe?
We have a something called a domestic violence protection notice or order, which came into law in 2010. In 2014, it went live, and we have. So this is a domestic violence protection notice is something that is an application that we complete and send to a superintendent to review once if there is insufficient evidence to take the matter to court and the suspect or perpetrator is released from the police station. We can do this application, which generates conditions upon someone where they may or may not be able to contact the victim or go to an address or stop them from a sort of evicting or making the victim homeless. This notice then comes within 48 hours. It needs to go to a magistrate. The magistrate then has a look at the application and can approve the order. This becomes a domestic violence protection order and can last up to 28 days. This often isn't what the victim or the suspect want, but it's really good to break the circle of domestic abuse. We also work with housing trusts and councils to get locks changed, to sometimes assist people in moving home. We can put in a panic alarms.
Does your role stop if the victim goes back to the perpetrator?
No, if victims go back to the perpetrators, the officers in the case will make regular contact with the victim, check in with them, make sure they're aware that there's ongoing support for them. A lot of the time, the victims will think because they've gone back to the perpetrator that the police sort of lose interest or aren't there to support them, but we will continue to support them regardless if that's their decision. We understand that if they go back to the relationship, that the risk is probably increased for them to be a further victim, and that we need to continue to support them.
Do you deal with cases where the perpetrator themselves is a victim?
Yes, we have a number of chaotic partners that are often both victims and suspects. Generally, other factors involved, such as alcohol, drug dependency, if they're not employed, they may use each other as benefits and things like that. Mental health is also a very big factor, so we would link in with mental health services, try and get the victim or the suspect the help that they need from the mental health services or the drug and alcohol.
What sort of support is available for both victims and perpetrators of domestic abuse who work for the police?
So we have counselling and occupational health referrals. We regularly advertise support for our internal intranet site. Each borough has a domestic abuse champion, and each officer or any officer who is a victim or a perpetrator will have a welfare officer assigned to them to make sure that they are okay and that they are being supported and that they are being dealt with the same way as a victim and suspect would be if they weren't police officers. We're able to restrict investigations so that only the investigating officer can view it to ensure confidentiality and that people aren't looking into the reports. Anyone accused of domestic abuse will be treated appropriately through the same channels as the public. Circumstances are individual and our response as police is tailored to that.
Now, we know that domestic violence and domestic abuse is grossly underreported, and it's very underreported in Waltham Forest. Why do you think that is, and what advice would you give to someone who might be going through it to keep safe?
So a lot of the time we find that a victim doesn't want to report the domestic abuse because they're in fear of the suspect or the perpetrator. I would say that a lot of people don't feel like that they will be believed, because a lot of the time with these incidents, it is one word against the other. It is just two people involved in an incident where they're the only people that actually know what happened. And I would say that people would fear that because the relationship is quite bad and the control element and the other person saying to them, oh, no one's going to believe you, and the threats of what will happen to you if you tell the police. We find that quite a lot. People are told that, and they're just so frightened of what will happen next to them from the perpetrator that they don't want to tell us. I would say for people that are going through domestic abuse, we are here to help. We are always willing to do whatever we can to try and support someone, help someone, regardless of if it being one incident or long-term issues. We would say that for people to keep safe is to end the relationship or to look for friends for support and advice, to seek help from charities and outside agencies. There's a brilliant charity called the National Centres for Domestic Violence who help with non-molestation orders and restraining orders and things like that. They are really helpful. They have a brilliant website that can help. And even if the victim doesn't feel like they want to go to court or any of that, they should still tell the police and still help the police to help them, basically. 101 is the non-emergency police number that covers any sort of crime. That will get through to the call centre. If they wish to speak to police officers, that can then be put through to the system to create a CAD number, which is a computer-aided dispatch that will send police officers a job to attend that address to take a report. There is also our online reporting system via the Met Police website, which people can use if they want to.
Well, PC Georgina Lodge, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you very much.
Karen Rabina, as we discussed, you got to a better place in your life after the nastiness. What are your feelings towards your abusers now?
I wish him no ill. I hope that he went on and got some help and that he went on to have a happy and fulfilled life. My life couldn't be better. I've got a great husband, and I hope that he definitely needed help. And I hope that he got the help that he needed to help him to go forward and not continue the behaviour that he did with me, and that he had a happy life with whoever he's with.
Do you forgive him?
Difficult to say. Do I forgive him? I think I've learnt to live with it. I don't know whether I forgive him. I don't wish him any ill. Whether I forgive him for some of the things that happened, and I haven't gone into them all here today, probably not, but I don't know. I'm very content with where I am now, and I don't actually think about him at all. And it's just today, in talking about it, that I've just thought to myself, actually, I just hope that he's had a good life.
Nelson Mandela, if you don't leave the bitterness behind, you'll always be in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that. And what about you, Rabina? What's the relationship you have with your...
My
ex-husband.
Yeah. We're very civil. We have two children together, and I encourage that relationship. And I think I feel like I'm at a place where I have forgiven him for what he did. And you know, I wish him well, and he seems to be getting on in his life, and I'm happy and content getting on with mine.
Do either of you know if your abusers got help, if there was help available to perpetrators at the time that the abuse was happening?
With my situation, there was alcohol involved. I know he did seek some help straight away to address that. In terms of abuse, we've never sat down and had a discussion. I've never really relayed. I mean, he knows that I feel it was unacceptable behaviour, but in terms of having a discussion where you label this was as abusive behaviour, we've never had that discussion, and I don't think that he himself would probably consider what he did as abusive.
Right. I thought you were going to say that you wouldn't have that discussion because there would be nothing to be gained from it. It would just be opening up a can of worms and going backwards, but you actually don't think he'd have any remorse or any embarrassment?
I think he would listen to me, but I feel like for me, I don't need to have that discussion with him. I think I've told him sufficiently in the past that certain behaviours were unacceptable, and that's in the past now for me. So there's no, I don't have anything to gain. I'm quite content where I am, and I think he has, as an individual, has to live with his actions and behaviours. So not my responsibility.
Yeah, whereas your conscience is clean because, you know, you got out and you got your children to safety. Yeah. I think that shows a real strength of character. Today's programme has been made possible by the community safety team in Waltham Forest, and we need to give a big thank you to Diane Andrews and Laura Butterworth for facilitating it and organising it and helping it happen. Ladies, closing remarks.
Just to say that, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. You can't change yesterday, but you can change your today and you can change your tomorrow.
I would say that don't give up. Just don't give up. There is definitely light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, I've had my own business. I'm a CEO of a charity, and I'm in a third term as a councillor, and have been a junior cabinet member. So there is definitely light at the end of the tunnel. You will come out stronger. So go for it.
And also, there's no need to suffer in silence.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, the help that perhaps wasn't available when you, Karen, were experiencing the abuse is now available.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can, there's so much now with social media that we knock, but you can do so much research now on your phone or computer and find out where you can get help and get independent advice. And as I said, there is definitely a life after domestic abuse.
There's always hope.
Yeah.
So if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence or abuse, or you suspect it's happening to someone in your community, then the number for Crime Stoppers is 0800 555 111. That's 0800 555 111. Also, the police non-emergency number is 101. And of course, if the matter is more pressing than that, then there is the emergency number of 999. The National Domestic Violence Helpline is available on 0808 2000 247. That's 0808 2000 247. Haven, the Survivors Network in Waltham Forest, is available on 0208 520 0755. That's 0208 520 0755. They can provide support to both children and adults experiencing abuse. There are also 5 refuges available in Waltham Forest. Another support group is Solace Women's Aid, whom we heard from earlier in the programme. Here's Cheryl with their contact information.
In an emergency situation, we always advocate that the police are called on 999. In terms of if you're wanting advice as to whether or not you're living in an abusive relationship, or if you want some advice in terms of how you can leave an abusive relationship, then the contact number for Waltham Forest is 07340 683382. We have a website, it's www.solacewomensaid.org.uk.
Thank you very much for tuning in and listening to this broadcast on East London Radio. We'll hope you'll feel inspired to report abuse when you experience it, because help really is at hand. I'm Rosie McLeod for East London Radio.